Space Science and Engineering Centre at Wisconsin for considerable periods, CNES in France, and recently I was director of the NASA NOAA and Department of Defence Joint Centre for Satellite Data Assimilation in Washington, and they were responsible for bringing all the new generation satellites online and setting them up to run and be ready to be used by the Weather Service, the Department of Defence, NASA and so on. So we basically saw all the new generation instrumentation into operations and took part in designing some of the systems. So what I'm going to do today is I've just taken this document here and I'm going to talk about it in relation to what goes on in the Bureau of Meteorology. Okay, so I'm going to talk about the Australian Government satellite utilisation policy, and I've just gone through this document and listed the elements, strengthening Australia's use of space, and I think this is germane to the Bureau's activity. 99.9% of our observations come from space, and as you'll see, they really determine the quality of our weather prediction and warning service. Why should Australia be involved in space? Well, in relation to the Bureau, we just can't do business without it. So strengthening our use of space and being involved is just most important to what we do. And these are the list of Australia's national goal in space. And it says here, Australia wishes to achieve the following. Well, nearly all these things: improved productivity, better environmental management, a safer and secure Australia. All these things actually pertain to the activities. You can go through each of these and see how the Bureau contributes to this. Obviously, we result in improved productivity, say by improving aviation forecasts, agricultural forecasts, allow better environmental management through our measurements. We provide a safe and secure Australia because we warn where tropical cyclones are coming. You can go through a myriad of applications that we do. A smarter workforce, a lot of the supercomputing initially was people were trained in the Bureau, and the activities we do in terms of, say, now solar radiation is becoming very important. A lot of that initial work will be done in the Bureau because you both measure it from space and you also predict it with a forecast model. So there's new industries and new activities all the time. And what I'm going to do is just step through how this document says we're going to achieve our space goal, and I'm going to go through each of the principles and just say a few words about each of them in relation to the Bureau's activity. First one is focus on space applications of national significance. Now, the ones listed here are Earth observations, satellite communications, and position, navigation, and timing. And it's interesting, especially in the forecast field, we use Earth observations from space. In fact, we use the communications, or the GPS satellites, the position and navigation and timing satellites, to measure temperature for us, which is not well known. And we also use communications to do our business. So on principle one, I'm going to talk about first Earth observations from space and the considerable impact they have in the Southern Hemisphere. And I think this will surprise you. If you look in the Southern Hemisphere and look at the impact of satellite data, you'll find that their impact's huge. And what we've done here is take an experiment where we've run our forecast with all the satellite data and non-satellite data together. We've run our forecast system with just our non-satellite data, and we've run it with the Bureau's operational model, ACCESS, and just so you don't believe us alone, we've also run the forecast with the forecast model from the USA, the NSEP model. So these are two operational models from two parts of the world, slightly different databases, and have been run without satellite data. Now, to give you a feeling for what goes on in an operational shop, we take data from approximately 30 to 40 satellite instruments every 6 hours. We cross-calibrate all the infrared instruments, the microwave instruments. We take the bending angle of GPS signals coming through the atmosphere because they're dependent on refractivity and temperature, and we can get temperature profiles out of those. And that was an ASRP research project that got that one started, so using GPS in this system. That also allows us to measure climate out over the oceans. We take clouds and we track every cloud on the map here and every bit of water vapour, and we produce winds through the atmosphere as well. So we go through this and we actually have to use 30 instruments, and probably in an operational shop we use 100,000 million observations a day. Because as well as using those instruments I talked to you about, there are other instruments that measure the spectrum in 8,000 or 3,000 channels. And each one of those measurements you view as an observation, and they all feed into the system. The advanced sounders that measure thousands of channels can measure temperature to a degree from the surface to the top of the atmosphere. So we can specify the atmosphere pretty well. Now, We put all these into our global forecast model, and these are just a list of the other data that's in there, mainly satellite data, but there's ship data, buoy data, aircraft data, and all these instruments is like acronym soup. I'm not going to go through it, but there's a large number of them. Our global model's about 47 kilometres, and what we find, if we run our global model and we measure something called the height at which the pressure reduces to 500 hectopascal, you get a map that looks a bit like a mean sea level pressure map with different numbers on it. And this is usually an indication of the skill of the forecast. How well you can forecast this field gives you an idea of how good the forecast model is. So what I've got here is these curves here, which are the decay curves showing how the forecast that's done with no satellite data decays with time. And this 0.9 is a correlation between the forecast and the verifying analysis. So you start off quite good with no satellite data after 24 hours. You're looking good. But very soon, you're pretty shabby. The forecast's not that flash. And what happens is if you look at, say, 0.9, you find if you start the system with satellite data in, it degrades, but it takes 4 days. At 4 days, the quality of a forecast with satellite data in is equal to the quality of a forecast without satellite data. So our forecast system without satellite data would be reasonably average. So that's run with our access model. Now, this is verified against the analysis with all the data in. And I'm not going to go into details of verification. But this is the one I just showed you. The quality of a forecast at 24 hours with no satellite data is equal to the quality of a forecast at 4 days with it. This is the US system. Same thing. 24 hours, the average is about 0.9 here. Without satellite data, 4 days, it's 0.9 again. So you get exactly the same gain running the US model over the Southern Hemisphere. Big gain from satellite data. Now, just to show you the nature of reality, these are the forecast curves for the Northern Hemisphere, for the people who pay for the satellites. They get half day or a bit more improvement in forecast through the satellite system. So this is something that I think people should bear in mind. These people are paying a lot of money for what they believe is an economic benefit, yet their impact's a fraction of that in the Southern Hemisphere. So I won't say any more than that. I think that's easy to work out for yourself. The other thing is so I've shown you anomaly correlations and it's amazing that the forecast skill is 1 day without satellite data, 4 days with it, have the same skill. The interesting thing is, what does this mean? Well, you take the access forecast for, say, heavy rain on the 9th of October. If you run with satellite data, you get heavy flooding rains in Victoria. Without satellite data, you've missed out. And this is a verifying analysis. Now, this, you might say, this is only one case, but I'll show you what the average for the month, but this is no fluke. And the interesting thing is that the message from this is, what does it mean? Well, an emergency manager needs 2 days' notice or 3 days' notice to get his truck out in the sandbags and prepare. You can't do that without a good long-range forecast, and you don't get a good long-range forecast without Earth observations from space. So when people ask you what are the economic benefits, you say, well, you're enjoying them all the time. When you see people, you know, sandbagging for floods or whatever, you're already enjoying the benefits. And if you look at the correlation between observed and forecast rain, you find it's 0.282, almost nothing with no satellite data, out of 2 to 3 days, 699 with it. So there's a considerable benefit. This, you say, okay, this was the 9th of November, what happens if you do a month? Well, you do a month, you still see a considerable improvement. I mean, this is averaging over a month, and it's, you know, speaks for itself. The other thing is tropical cyclones. Now, instead of doing this in Australia where it's duck soup, because out over the oceans there's very few planes, very few ships, I did this in the Atlantic with the US run. So this shows you here, you've got the blue line's the truth. This is the start of the Tropical Cyclone Earl's track, 24 hours, 48 hours. When you run with satellite data, you get the red track, almost on top. Run without it, you get the green track. So the errors are quite big. That's in an area with plenty of aircraft, plenty of ships, more observations we get in the Southern Ocean. So this just shows you another model, similar result. And if you look over a whole season, not just one case, you see 36 hours, 2 days, the forecast track errors are doubled without satellite data. That's in an area where we've got plenty of ops. So what I'm saying, I guess the message is, Earth observations from space have a considerable impact on our way of life now. I mean, our forecast of prediction facts for tropical cyclones are probably depend on this data, as well as rainfall and other important things. So that's principle one. Principle two, assure access to space capability. And I guess the things the Bureau does to assure access, we participate in the planning of EOS. We CalVal EOS data for other people. We participate in the collection and distribution of this data. We collect data from the satellites and retransmit to other parts of their globe for their global model. And hopefully in the future, when the Cosmic Constellation, which is a group of satellites that measure radio occultation as a bending of GPS signals, we'll probably end up putting I've got this grey because it hasn't been signed off, but we'll probably put a reception station for the Cosmic Constellation in Northern Australia. And if we were very brave, we could actually put two cosmic receivers that cost about $300,000 each onto two satellites like FedSat, we've already practiced once, put them into space and become a full partner. And the reason I say that is because visibility for us in this game, I think, is important because we're so dependent on the activity. Okay, we also, in Australia, process winds from observations from space and distribute those, and we process atmospheric moisture, and we've developed focal plane arrays for ATSR, AATSR, and I should put a whole lot of dots here, I haven't got time. But the Bureau's been involved with, this being part of the team assures our access, helps assure our access to space data. Principle three, strengthen and increase international cooperation. Well, I guess the Bureau's heavily involved through WMO, and we've got an ex-president of the WMO in the room now, and we're also involved in the Asia-Pacific Satellite Data Utilisation Forum, and through a whole lot of satellite-related activities that actually strengthen our international cooperation. In fact, people from Australia are involved in the technical panels of NOAA, helping to produce the next generation of operational satellites. So Australia has a fairly strong involvement overseas. We contribute to a stable space environment, and that's through WMO and all those things. We improve domestic coordination. I guess the Bureau has been involved in the planning of ground station facilities because we have a large number of ground stations, and I'm not going to go through the acronym, but this was written up and provided as a starting point for the foundation of the Australian ground station system. We participate in the distribution of EOS data. We've developed a very capable scientific processing capability, and we've developed coordinated processing capacity around the whole country. And this involves not just us, it involves the universities, CSIRO and others, where we've collaborated to produce a strong system that can be used by all. And where impossible, we've been involved in this. We've put in applications. We've been involved with VIPAC in, the GGM and so on. And I don't know whether that'll ever go anywhere, but if it does, that's the sort of instrument that we'll have to deploy for environmental intelligence to be able to measure CO2 in the atmosphere and so on. Number six is support innovation, science and skills development. And I guess we've been involved with the ASRP and lots of activities in terms of developing the science and developing the operational processing of EOS data. We've worked out new techniques for, in fact, it was an Australian who first worked out how to get big impact from the advanced sounders, which are probably the most significant instrument in the sky. We've done a lot of work in developing EOS-related skills, supported postgrads, postdocs, and done a lot of training. And we've been involved with a lot of people, so in actually supporting innovation, science, and providing skills development. And clearly, we support the Defence Department. We look at the change of climate, which is important for the country's long-term well-being. We support agriculture, have specialised forecast and warning systems. So most of them are just reasonably straightforward. In terms of Australian government responsibilities, where does the Bureau appear? In the document I showed you, we appear under one of our partners in Earth Observations from Space. The Bureau is named there, and also for space weather. Like NSEP in the USA, meteorology and space weather have been combined together. And I think it's probably a good idea because the instruments for this, say, for instance, on the US satellites, weather satellites, all the space weather instruments are on the same satellite, and when you go through the review process, which I've been involved in, you actually have to review those instruments and also make sure that the package is going to space and healthy. So that's the way things are, and it's probably a sensible thing. The coordination framework you've told us all about before, so we all know about that. And I think I was asked when I came here, what impact will this policy have on our projects and plans? Well, I'm really happy to say it sort of reinforces our current approach. I think what's written down in this policy is really common sense, we thought. It's good, but I guess the detail is a bit to get you. What opportunities does it open up? Well, I think that clearly indicates support for space applications of national significance, and I think an efforts that will focus on space application of a significant security, economic, social and impact. Okay, specifically the Earth observation, these three. And I think the Bureau's activity clearly falls within this very strongly. And I think the Bureau's probably, in terms of having support, you would think from reading this document, we'll have a significant amount of support for our activity. And given what I showed you about the importance of Earth observation from space, it's almost a common sense approach. What initiatives do you advocate for government, private industry and the research sector? Well, I think the obvious answer is a balanced investment in infrastructure, research and people. I think we need to do this. I think if we don't do this, our access to space may not be as free as we think it is. When I was director of the Joint Center in Washington, I went to meetings with NASA, NOAA and the DOD in our very high-level meetings. And I can tell you here that the Australian Academy of Science in this strategy plan talked about Australia being viewed as a free rider. And that, in fact, you go to these meetings and that, in fact, is true, particularly when the US and European economy went down and ours didn't. This was this was mentioned openly. So I think we've got to be visibly seen to have a balanced investment in infrastructure, research and people, and actually be seen to be a partner of the community. This is not a sales job. I'm just telling you how it appeared to me. It was reasonably straightforward. I guess the other part of the summary is, just in a little bit, I went off talking about EOS. Analysis and prediction using current and future satellite systems have been examined. We've noticed the great benefits. There's huge benefits still to come. We're only just scratching and this isn't a sales pitch, we're only using a small fraction of the data that's coming down, 5 or 10%. There'll be significant improvements. The economic benefits will be significant. And what's more, billions are still being put into future instruments at the moment and future space activity. And I think, as I said, we need careful investment in infrastructure, research and trained staff to make sure we can take benefits that offers. And my last thought is, talk about space business, looking down is looking up. And I'll stop there. Thank you.